Our next case on the docket today is Cloudflare, Inc. v. Sable Networks, Inc., appeal number 23-1612. Mr. Garza, whenever you're ready, you can proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The Board should have granted Cloudflare's request to correct the IPR petition. The Court should reverse for two reasons. First, the Board improperly conditions its power to correct IPR petitions on the category of error, here typographical errors, in other cases clerical or non-substantive errors. This is not the correct legal standard. The Board can exercise its discretion to correct any type of error if it leads to just results. The Court should remand and allow the Board to reconsider under the correct legal standard. Second, on this record, the Board abused its discretion by failing to correct Cloudflare's petition. Sable had 4 months to respond after the Board identified Cloudflare's error, but Sable's response identified no prejudice, and more importantly, did not identify any additional substantive arguments for the four dependent claims at issue.
Counsel, did Cloudflare ever ask the Board to consider whether the alleged error in the petition was obvious as opposed to typographical?
Cloudflare did not make that request in the briefing. However, because the court raised the error sua sponte in its order, that shows that the error is obvious. It's something the court figured out by reading the petition and through its analysis. So the best evidence that the error is obvious is that the court found it sua sponte.
What does that mean, that something is obvious?
Well, I think the best standard we have for it is from the biotech case that we cited in our briefing. And that means that a lawyer reading through the analysis and analyzing it would understand that a mistake was made. And here, as we showed in our brief in the statement of facts, any lawyer that analyzes how the independent claims relate to the dependent claims would see that it's error to argue that the ground one, the Young-only ground, would apply to the multiply dependent claim when all of the independent and dependent claims above it rely on Young and Copeland.
Well, in your statements, if it's so obvious, why didn't Cloudflare ask to correct it before the Board pointed out the error?
Because we didn't notice it. Lawyers are human. We didn't notice the error until the court brought it up and noticed it for us. Once we noticed the error, we immediately owned up to it. We wrote an email. We said, we made an error. We need to, and in the briefing, we asked to correct it. And we are challenging that decision, the decision not to correct the petition.
You've got two arguments. One is you're arguing they should have corrected it even under the standard that they applied, that there was a typographical error in the petition, right? But you're also arguing that the Board should have considered a different standard that it didn't consider. But it's a standard that you're mentioning for the first time in your briefing before this court. Is that right? I mean, I don't think that you asked the Board to apply a different standard other than the typographical error standard.
Well, we certainly asked the court to correct the petition. I don't think there's any argument about that.
But under the typographical error standard.
Well,
I mean, I'm asking you a very easy question.
Oh, I understand, and I want to make sure I get it.
I mean, I want to know whether you asked the board to apply the standard that you're asking for this court to say is the proper standard. Did you ask the board ever to apply that standard?
I want to be precise. Our request for to correct did not mention typographical errors at all. And I can read it for you.
But answer her direct question about did you ask them about the obvious standard that you've been arguing to us?
No. Our request just said, please allow us to amend, to correct the petition, to move these arguments to ground two. That was the request. It was very simple. It didn't say because it's a typographical error, because you have to do this because it's a typographical error. Our secondary request, and again, it was in the footnote of our reply brief, said please move these arguments to the correct ground. So we did not say because it was an obvious error, but we did not only limit our requests to typographical errors.
Now, in the board in its decision to institute said, we're not sure if this is an error under the typographical error standard.
Yes.
That correct?
The board in its decision said, we believe this could be a typographical error. The board is the one that brought up typographical errors to begin with, yes.
Okay, but you're saying it's not a typographical error, it's something else.
Well, to be clear, during the middle of the administrative proceeding, no, we definitely argued it was a typographical error. For this court's purposes, no, we're not challenging that finding that it's not a typographical error. But
qualitatively, if you could explain to me what the difference is between a typographical error and a substantive error.
It's a good question. I don't think you can make a dichotomy like that. I think there are plenty of typographical errors out there that are substantive errors. I think there are plenty of clerical errors out there that also are substantive. I think an easy example we raised in our brief is when you file a PDF, and let's say you forget to put a page in there. It happens. That affects the substance of the petition. If you have a page missing, you can't interpret that error away. You can't guess at what the party meant to say. That said, it can be an error that you correct. I think that is a clerical type error that even though it affects the substance of the petition, any board or court could accept that this was obviously unintended and should be corrected.
Well, is it unintended if it's in a summary, it's in the body, it's in a sort of formal conclusion, it runs through the papers? How is someone to determine that that was not intended to be that way?
Well, to be clear, I don't think intentional is a bar we have to pass to get to the court's discretion. I do think the court's discretion
may consider
this. You're
saying it was an obvious error, meaning
yes.
That it shouldn't be the way it is.
Correct.
That you wanted it to be another way.
Obviously.
Right. So how is someone to determine that? And if it's a continuum, how is the court supposed to respond to that?
Well, I think the court does have the difficult position of exercising its discretion to make this determination. I think there's a lot of things the court can and should consider when making this type of decision. Diligence, reliance, prejudice. Whether this is truly obvious to a patent lawyer that knows how to do their job.
I believe your adversary said they looked at the papers and they thought that that's how you interpreted this issue. Even though they responded to it, and we'll get to that soon, even though they responded to this issue and the two sources that were that you're hoping that this actually references at this point, Young and Copeland, how is anyone supposed to respond to this and actually make a determination on it? Because, again, it's running through the entirety of the document.
I do understand it runs through the entirety of the document, and I understand that as a practicing attorney. Once you make the initial mistake, the original sin, in putting into the wrong section, whoever is writing the summaries looks at that and makes the same mistake. I can understand how that happens. But from the court's perspective, I think there were two decisions they had to make. One, is it fair to interpret the petition to read out this error? And they said, no, it's not. We're not challenging that determination. And we think under the Apple case, that's a reasonable conclusion that the court came to. We're looking at something a little different. It's clear there's an error here to us, and I get that's something for the court to decide. But we think the standard is different when the court has to determine whether they should correct the petition. A correction does presuppose we're saying there's something wrong in there, that the court should look at it and
you
correct it.
You say the court, but you mean the board.
I do
right?
mean the board.
I just want to make sure it's not like we're going to correct the petition.
Correct, yeah, the board.
Okay.
I apologize.
Okay. Let me ask you some other questions, because my understanding is this isn't the first sort of IPR petition, right, on
correct.
These claims. So didn't Palo Alto Networks have a petition as well?
Yes.
And wasn't this same alleged error in the Palo Alto Networks petition?
Correct.
So it's multiple parties putting the exact same error in, with that, which I'm going to assume had different attorneys as well.
Correct. And I do think this is an artifact of the joinder practice in IPRs at the board, where when you're looking to join a petition, you do copy it word for word to make sure that the joinder will be granted. In a perfect world, had we noticed this error, the proper procedure would have been to file the petition and immediately ask the court to correct it. We did not notice the error.
Okay, I want to ask you some other questions before
sure.
your time runs out. Do you agree that claims 17, 18, 37, and 38 are not asserted against any defendant active litigation?
I agree.
Okay. So maybe just give me a sense of why do you care so much that we're here on this appeal about these four claims?
Sure. This patent, from my calculation, expires in December 2027. So there's nothing stopping the defendant from asserting it against Cloudflare. Also, Cloudflare, as a company, has taken a very strong stance against patent litigation that it sees as frivolous. I'm not trying to make any sort of judgment call here. But it is important for Cloudflare to take appeals and ensure that claims that we see as invalid are invalidated. That's why we brought this IPR petition.
But currently, these particular claims are not asserted against Cloudflare.
No, the district court litigation concluded in December. We did win the verdict. And right now, there are no claims currently asserted against Cloudflare.
And you also agree that claims 17, 18, 37, and 38 are not shown by Young alone?
No, you do need Copeland to show the badness factor limitation.
Because
so you do
agree.
Oh, sorry.
So the answer is yes, as opposed to no, right?
Yes, okay. Correct.
Go ahead.
The district court litigation is concluded, so not only is there not currently any litigation in which they're asserting those claims against you, they cannot assert those claims against you. Right?
That's unclear. So those claims were withdrawn very early in the litigation. In the middle of the litigation, Sable attempted to add the claims back in, and the court denied, but not because they could never bring it against us ever, but because it was too late in the litigation to bring them. I think it's an open question when patent claims are dismissed very early in the litigation, and with our agreement, dismissed early in the litigation, whether collateral estoppel or res judicata could stop it. I think that's an open question for the district court if they chose to sue us again.
I mean, aren't there some claim splitting concerns there, though?
Well, my understanding is under res judicata that each patent claim is its own cause of action. So the question is, can you bring a cause of action, let's say, I don't know, conversion, if it's dismissed by agreement of the parties before discovery occurs, could you bring it again? I think you can. But again, I think it depends very much on the facts, and I certainly am not comfortable enough for them to tell you how it would come out here.
Can you tell us, just because you said the litigation is concluded, how did it end up concluding? Was it a settlement? Oh, verdict. Okay.
Yeah. So there was one claim ultimately went to verdict, and the jury found it not infringed and invalid.
Was it a claim, independent claim?
It was, but it was in a different patent.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Hipskin? Did I
get your
name correctly?
You did. Thank you. Daniel Hipskin, on behalf of the appellee, patent owner, Sable Networks, Inc., may it please the court. Cloudflare filed the IPR petition giving rise to this appeal only a month and a half into the one-year 315B window for the statutory bar. And approximately 7 months in is when the institution decision came out flagging this potential issue. And this is relevant because there were still 4 months of the window. And so I wanted to respond to one thing that Mr. Garza mentioned. He said that after the board flagged this potential mistake, we question whether it's a mistake or not, but Assuming it's a mistake, it was flagged, and Mr. Garza said that we had 4 months to respond to that. But 37 CFR 42.104C, that puts the burden for filing a motion to correct the petition on the party, the petitioner that filed the petition with the mistake in it. And so this is all to say that there were 4 months left in the statutory bar where not only could they have filed a petition, or sorry, a motion for correction, but if that was denied, they could file a new petition, a follow-on petition under 325D. So this is all to say that Cloudflare didn't do anything procedurally to help themselves out if this was a genuine good faith mistake.
All right. So are you addressing then the issue of diligence there? Or is it more technical than that?
If you were to adopt the standard that Cloudflare is advocating, that would certainly go to diligence. Mm-hmm. But we're not advocating that diligence is a factor under the typographical error standard that was the only standard that Cloudflare ever asked the board to apply, and under the applicable 104C. Mm-hmm. So that's to say, I don't believe diligence is relevant, but this is to show you the factual background that was considered by the board, because when you're considering whether they abused their discretion, I think it's important to note this factual background that, you know, this wasn't this obvious mistake that they're arguing now for the first time on appeal. You know, this is something that, as Judge Cunningham was pointing out, this has been propagated by many parties. And I think even more relevant than the Palo Alto Networks is the fact that Splunk Inc. Mm-hmm. filed a petition and a motion to join 5 days after the institution decision.
And so it has the same error in it, right?
Alleged
error. Let me put alleged.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So 5 days after this large technology company represented by Morrison and Forrester, you know, very competent, skilled patent counsel, files with the exact same argument that these four claims at issue were invalid as obvious under Young alone. And so that really kind of calls into doubt whether this was an error as opposed to a strategic decision. As Mr. Garza pointed out, this was a patent portfolio, both in the litigation between the parties. There were four patents at the beginning. Sable's portfolio as a whole had even more patents. And so,
do you have a position on whether or not these four claims would ever be asserted against Cloudflare? Like, I have to admit, when I saw this, I was like, why are we here? Why are you guys arguing in front of us?
Well, John, because we received the invitation, I suppose they appealed. in terms of the issue that you were raising,
we appreciate that you accepted the invitation to come speak.
But in terms of the claim splitting and collateral estoppel issue, that's not before the court on this appeal, and I similarly agree with Mr. Garza that that's an open question. You know, it was withdrawn under the claim narrowing process that
Judge Albright... You withdrew these four claims under the claim narrowing
process. We did in September 2021. So as Mr. Garza pointed out, very early in the litigation. So I believe that there's case law that suggests that's tantamount to a dismissal without prejudice when they're voluntarily and by agreement withdrawn through the discovery process. So the truthful direct answer is I don't know, and I agree that it's an open question, and we certainly reserve the right to explore that, but I don't know today.
Do you know, and I apologize for not having the answer to this, but hopefully you will, because you should know your case well. Do you know whether or not judgment that was entered post-verdict addresses these claims?
It does not.
It does not.
Okay. The only patent that, anyway, it does not. The entirety of the 593 patent that's at issue in this appeal was withdrawn very early in the litigation. The judgment there would be summary judgment as to one patent and the verdict on the patent that went to the jury trial.
I just want to go back to this purported error showing up in so many different documents. What was your response when you saw that? What were you thinking? Were you thinking this is a strategic issue on their part, or how did you respond?
When it was flagged by the board, mm-hmm. And then they sent the email that Mr. Garza referenced, I think we took it at face value that it was a mistake, and we assumed that they would deal with it. Like I mentioned, either the 104C motion to correct, or potentially a follow-on petition. And when they didn't, I would say, sitting here today, there's serious reservations as to whether that was a strategic decision. But in either event, the arguments weren't there. Only Young was asserted, as you pointed out. Judge Checky?
Checky, excellent.
Okay. This wasn't, you know, just kind of one inconsistency. This was in the expert declaration. This was in the summary table. This was discussed throughout the petition. So standing here today, I believe that strategic decisions were made along the way to not try to correct it.
And I recognize that it refers to prior art and whether it's a reference to Young and Copeland together. And at some point in your briefing below, you did in fact treat it as if it were corrected, because you referenced, I believe it's claims 17 and 18 and 37 and 38 on your heading, and then you went into Copeland, which is the issue here as to the error. So what was the basis for doing that?
The idea that the board might correct it. Basically, the board has wide discretion as to whether to correct or not, and so we certainly didn't want to be caught flat-footed if the board did correct what they viewed as an error.
So you treated it as corrected to make sure you covered that argument?
Only in the alternative. Mm-hmm. You know, we certainly argued to the board that this was not a typographical error, that it should not be corrected. But yes, in the alternative, should we not have persuaded the board on those first two points, we certainly did advance the argument under Young and Copeland. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of typographical errors versus obvious errors, how do you see the difference there?
I don't see an applicable standard for an obvious error. There's the typographical error. There are late action errors that can be corrected. The other side has addressed this in their briefing.
What's a late action error?
That's the error that was at issue in the Maine Pharma versus Merck case discussed in their brief. And in that particular case, it was identifying a real party in interest that basically if the petitioner lost its filing date due to the fact that they were late in identifying the real party in interest, then they would have been time barred. So that was the issue there, and that court said, you know, this doesn't at all implicate 104C or typographical clerical errors. It's under 42.5, which addresses late action. So there are various regulations as to how to correct different errors, but there isn't an applicable CFR or a IPR statutory provision that says that the board members have this broad discretion to correct anything that they deem.
So then to follow up on that, you're distinguishing Stoddard as well as the Bennett case?
Yes.
Okay, with respect to signatures and inventorship, if you'd like to describe your point of reference there for distinguishing that.
Sure. In Bennett and Stoddard, the court walks through the congressional history and says that there are correction statutes, but they were simply outside. The fact patterns were slightly outside. For example, in, I believe it's Bennett, there was a reissue application that needed to be filed within 2 years, and the applicant had the signature of an officer of the assignee and not the inventor. And in order to correct that, the correction would have fallen outside the 2 years. And because the correction statute said you could do it on the actual issued patent but not the application, the office rejected it. And so there, the court walked through congressional history, which was, you know, Congress was concerned about overly rigid bureaucratic limitations on patent applicants. There is no such congressional history for the inter-parties review. In fact, the IPR statute gives complete discretion to the director and the PTO as to whether to institute or not, and that's non-appealable. So
you view it as a different statutory structure and a different factual scenario. Certainly a different interest. I believe on one of them it was inventorship, and the other, as I indicated, was a signature that had to be changed.
Yes.
Is there any other issue that you would find as a distinguishing factor? Does it matter that these were decided before IPR was created?
Before what?
IPR, the Inter Partes Review, was created.
I don't think that matters as a distinction, but I guess what I would say is here we have correction statutes. The deference as to whether to institute a petition or not has been delegated to the board and to these administrative patent judges by the director. Mm-hmm. And that delegation is pursuant to the, you know, IPR regulatory, you know, set of rules. And so the PTAB judges, when they're instituting an IPR, they're doing it pursuant to the regulations that exist.
Okay. So in terms of the most significant point of reference, from your perspective, what we should be guided by, what would that be to say this is not something that we can address, an obvious error?
I would say that there is no statute or regulation that permits the PTAB judges to correct errors other than what has been delegated to them by the director through a proper APA rulemaking procedure.
And do you also rely a little bit on SAS in that respect, that, you know, you've got the Supreme Court saying it's really important what the petition says and it sets the table for the whole proceeding?
Exactly. Yes, Your Honor. We certainly rely on that. SAS says that while the PTO has broad discretion in whether to institute or not, once it's instituted, it's guided by the petition from start to finish, and that the PTO has very little control over how to conduct the proceeding once they've decided to institute.
And I assume you're also still contending that there was either forfeiture or waiver of this obvious theory because it was never presented to the board in the first place?
Yes, absolutely. At every step of the way, the Cloudflare below at the board, again, before the first brief was filed here, in the petitioner's reply, which was not filed until 7 months after this was first identified in the institution decision, they only argued typographical error. And Mr. Garza was pointing to the footnote on the very last page of that reply for the proposition that they don't call it a typographical error. But if you actually look at the text in the page above that it's dropping the footnote from, they use typographical error throughout that whole discussion. So from start to finish.
And you know what, in terms of that, why wouldn't this obvious argument be an extension of the typographical issue argument?
I'm going to try to answer. I'm not sure I understand, so I'll just jump in.
And I'm basically referring to it as potentially being an evolving argument, starting with this is a typographical error and an amplification. This is an obvious error. Do you think there's any validity to that?
They call it an obvious typographical error
in
throughout,
that, but it was raised initially. Could we view this as being raised initially as the same argument?
I would argue no, but I guess I would argue in the alternative that if you do, then we're saying that they're applying the typographical clerical error standard that exists in the regulations and that we would be viewing this with abuse of discretion. Mm-hmm. And if the board applied the standard that exists, this typographical error, mm-hmm. and now we're just expanding on that, then this court should apply the abuse of discretion standard, and that gets back into the kind of factual background that under that, you know, extremely deferential standard, this court should certainly uphold the board's decision.
But nonetheless, you're construing them to be two separate, entirely different arguments, typographical error versus obvious error.
Yes. Yeah, and I'm suggesting that those are two different standards, and I believe, I'm sure Mr. Garza will correct me if I'm wrong, that they would agree, because if this court applies the abuse of discretion standard, you know, they have a very steep uphill climb. So what they want to do is say there's this new standard, and the PTO erred by not applying this separate standard. I'm suggesting they've waived that argument.
Thank you.
I see my time's up.
Okay, thank you for your argument. Mr. Garza, you have over 2 minutes.
I'm going to try to make 3 points.
Okay.
First, I would like to point the court to the Maine Pharma case. In that case, the court did allow the correction of real parties and interests after the filing of the petition, despite having no regulatory explicit power to do so. They did not rely on 42.104C, which is the only power explicitly given to correct petitions, but instead they allowed the correction to go through anyway. So that negates this idea that you need explicit regulatory power to correct the petition. Second, in an exercise of discretion, a proper exercise of discretion by the board in considering a motion to correct, they should consider the interest in SAS. The notice required by the APA is paramount in these cases, but there are situations where it still makes sense to allow correction of the petition. I'd like to point the court to the fact pattern in the Varian case that we cited at page 32 of our brief. In that brief, the applicant, instead of filing a power of attorney and a petition, filed two powers of attorney. It's terrifying. Like, that is something that every attorney is just scared will happen to them. The court said, too bad. 42.104C limits our ability to correct this mistake, and they refused to correct it. They said, you did not file a petition, and we cannot help you.
Can I ask you, do you agree with the timeline that opposing counsel put forth in terms of there being 4 months between when, I guess, the board pointed out the error and when you had kind of that sort of one-year time limit to file petitions? Is his timeline accurate?
Honestly, I'm not sure. I don't remember what his timeline was. But what I know happened is the board put out its order in, I believe, November. And the Sable did have 4 months to file their first response addressing the error. We filed our reply, and then they filed a surreply, and there was questioning and oral argument. So there was ample time to argue about whether the error existed and how to address it. Those are my points. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted.